Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Every year on or near Earth Day, we check in with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble, author of Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America. Today on Earth Day, we talk with Trimble and three scientists, and our topic this year is the dismantling of government science. Americans lost a generation of federal scientists, public land managers, and park rangers when the Trump administration fired thousands of government employees last year. Some other examples of ongoing actions from the administration. The Forest Service announced a move to Salt Lake City. There's a plan to close most Forest Service research stations, which will affect projects that have been ongoing for decades. And many senior researchers have left in protest or in search of job security. We're going to talk about this on the program today with the following guests. We welcome in Paul Hesburgh, who's research ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest Research Station, an affiliate professor at University of Washington. Over 45 years of research, he's explored wildfire and climate change effects on landscape and wildfire dynamics and structure and organization of historic current and future landscape resilience. In 2023, he received the Distinguished Landscape Ecologist Award from International Association for Landscape Ecology. Paul Hesburgh, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you being on. Jackie Grant joins us. She has a long history of collaborating as a scientist with federal land managers versus a researcher, professor of geosciences, and museum curator at Southern Utah University. With expertise in seed biology, conservation biology, and the intersection between indigenous cultures and plants, now is executive director of the Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, the official friends group of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, where she works closely with Bureau of Land Management and scientists conducting research on the monument. Jackie Grant, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Good to have you with us. And we also have with us Anna Knight, who's an ecologist focused on landscape-scale vegetation dynamics. Her research investigates the impacts of human land use, climate change, and environmental disturbances on dryland ecosystems. She worked for the National Park Service and U.S. Geological Survey in southeast Utah and northern Arizona for 10 years before leaving her scientific career to focus on in the face of continuing threats and job insecurity. She now teaches EMT classes for USU and Grand County EMS in Moab. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's jump in, talk about this topic again, the dismantling of government science. So, Jackie, let's go to you first. You're a longtime educator, so government science, let's parse that out and talk about science. What is science? I guess we think we know it, but give us the definition.
Absolutely. Right. So science is just this systematic process where people use evidence to study the natural world, and they use observation and experiments to learn more about the world in this very evidence-based fashion that's very systematic. And it is one way of knowing and understanding our world, but it's not the only way.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Trimble, I neglected to fully introduce you, so let me do that now. Stephen Trimble has published 25 award-winning books during 50 years of paying attention to the landscapes and peoples of the Desert West. He depended on government science to inform many of these books. Worked for the National Park Service, Bureau of Land Management, USD Forest Service in his 20s. This fall, he's publishing the much-updated 35th anniversary edition of his classic book on natural history of the Great Basin Desert, Sagebrush Ocean. So, Stephen Trimble, I just kind of assumed everybody knows Stephen Trimble, but I'll give you that introduction. So, Stephen and I are going to be kind of alternating with questions. So, go ahead, Stephen.
Well, thank you, Tom. Those numbers make me sound so old, but I have been doing this for a long time. And I really wanted to focus on this subject, partly because my dad worked for the U.S. Geological Survey for 30 years. And when I was a kid, our whole social circle were folks who were government scientists. And I thought of them as the models for me to be a good human being and a good man and to do good work that was very much in the public interest. And in those days, those geologists were doing classic field work. They were kind of all versions of John Wesley Powell. And so I've been deeply disturbed by what's happening to government science now. And I'm going to ask Paul to start with to tell us a little bit about why federal science matters so much. And why do you think we need so many scientists in public service, like my dad and like yourself?
Thanks, Stephen. That's a great question. Before I begin with an answer, I'd like to clarify that I'm a recently retired federal scientist. I spent 42 years as a public servant in research for the Forest Service, and now I'm working as an affiliate professor about half time. To answer the question, the National Forest System has relied on a science management partnership for very, very many decades. And the reason why that's really critical is that it gives us the opportunity to base management on the people's lands using the best available science. And so quite often what we're doing is we're answering deeply important questions about what's going on with forest change, or why wildfires are getting worse, or what's up with climate change and why are we seeing more large and severe fires. Well, our research works on that. And then those findings we publish in peer-reviewed journals, and then we make them accessible to managers in a variety of different forums that are available to us. So the science management partnership is ultra critical to informing not only what is the best available science, but then how can we apply it to do better work on the people's lands.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about what the impacts are of policy changes that we're seeing now?
Like I said, this partnership is really critical. And so when you are an organization who by its planning processes implies that the best available science will be applied to the management of the people's lands, when you remove that, you remove the application of the best available science. And the questions about how to do good work in a rapidly warming and drying climate, those questions are getting more intense. And so there's actually a greater need for broader understanding of how climate, environment, forests interact to produce conditions that are not only resilient, but also are responsive to changes. When you remove that science basis, you end up not knowing, not being able to show what those clear linkages are. And so the throughput of science to application on the ground is really critical. And you can see when that linkage is broken, the implication is we don't know the effects of what we're doing on the land.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And Anna, you made a shift from being a national park ranger to becoming an ecologist and thinking about all these same things. What made you want to be a scientist?
Yeah, I have spent a lot of my career switching sort of back and forth, switching hats between science research and science education. And so the progression from National Park Ranger, where I was providing education and visitor services, helping people understand and connect intellectually and emotionally to the landscapes that we treasure here in the American West, the progression from that to seeking novel understanding and pursuing my curiosity and sort of exploring these landscapes with an eye towards questions that really matter to the citizens of the American West, that felt like a really natural progression to me. You know, I'd have visitors come to me when I was working for the Park Service, and they'd ask, you know, sometimes they'd ask standard questions, where's the bathroom? Lots of times they'd ask that. But a lot of times you'd get visitors with these really interesting questions, and I'd be like, I'm stumped. I don't know the answer to that question. And that sort of pursuing, I had so much fun pursuing the answers to those questions that it felt like a great move to step over into science and start answering some of those questions that we couldn't puzzle out together in the visitor center.
But we know that you have not been able to continue in that scientific career, right? So can you tell us your story?
Yeah, so after switching from Park Service to science research, I worked for about 10 years in ecology research, working as a botanist and a field biologist. I did my graduate research in Reno with the Forest Service Research Station in Reno, and then spent many of the past few years with the U.S. Geological Survey and the Southwest Biological Science Center, where I worked on questions related to how, like basically the questions that we were trying to ask and answer were how do we live in, recreate on, use and conserve these landscapes sustainably for the long term for current and future generations. And so I asked a lot of questions about drought and climate change and how those shifting concerns would shape the future of our public lands. We ask questions about human land use disturbances, things like grazing and what level of grazing is appropriate for an ecosystem versus what constitutes improper or too much grazing for a landscape. Questions about oil and gas and whether you can have sustainable oil and gas development on public lands. And what are the impacts of those things for wind erosion, wildfire, water availability, all kinds of things that impact everyone who lives in the West. And that career was cut short in the past year, sort of starting with the Valentine's Massacre, as we call it, the firing of many probationary employees. So my husband actually also works in federal science, works for the Park Service in federal science, and he had just gotten this brand new exciting Park Service science job in 2024, which put him in his probationary first year probationary period when the administration decided to fire all of the probationary employees. And so he was fired actually on Valentine's Day of 2025, less than 12 hours before we left for our honeymoon. So we spent most of our honeymoon trying to figure out like how to apply for unemployment and how do you contact people in Utah when you're across the ocean. And it was really difficult for us. And so he was out of work for about 5 weeks, and then thankfully was reinstated due to some union actions and some judges' orders. He was reinstated, and so he is actually still in that job. But it was a really difficult month for us to try to figure out what the future for us looked like. And after he was reinstated, we still both were in these really insecure jobs where we were faced with threats of reduction in force or RIFs. You'll hear us call them RIFs a lot, but reductions in force, basically meaning looking to cut as many people as we can from their jobs. And both of our offices were very specifically targeted as like top priority for RIFs. And so that felt very unstable. There were a few judges' orders that blocked those, and so things got extended out. But that threat hovered for many months. And then in the meantime, even when judges' orders had blocked those things, we were dealing with all sorts of other ways of throwing sand in the gears of our work, things from threatening our building leases, right? So we were all required to come back to work in person. No more teleworking was allowed. And then they tried to cancel our building lease. And we were like, well, where are we supposed to work? If we have to be in person and we don't have a building to work in, what does that mean for us as employees? Do we have to move? Do we have to quit? Like, what does that look like? We experienced many layers of new administrative busy work, things that on the surface seemed justified to maybe provide more control over spending or something like that. But in practice, really, we already had a lot of those safeguards in place. So things like approving credit card purchases, they reduced all of our credit card balances to $1 or all of our credit limits to $1. So you essentially couldn't purchase anything on a credit card, which meant that we couldn't pay our internet bill for our office. And so we spent so much salary time trying to figure out how to pay our internet bill. Like that's what a silly use of government funds to pay someone to figure out how to pay your internet bill. We received emails that were demeaning our work and calling us low productivity. And these are people who, like, I interned for a year and a half before I got my Park Service job. I worked for less than half of minimum wage for a year and a half in order to earn this place. And so that was really difficult to see that work demeaned in that way. Mm. And then I also worked as a term employee. And so that meant that my employment was on a year-to-year contract. And every single term employee had their contract threatened, essentially. Like, we had to justify them in 144 characters or less every time those renewals came up. And so my term had to be renewed right when the government shut down. And so when the government shut down in September, I didn't know if I still had a job for like a month. I didn't know whether that action had gone into place. And so that was when I decided that we really needed more stability for my family. I have type 1 diabetes, which is really expensive, and I have to have health insurance in order to be a healthy person, because it's so expensive to take care of that disease without health insurance. And so my husband and I decided that we really needed to have one of us have a stable job with health insurance. And I feel so incredibly grateful to my community that when I went to my community and said, I'm scared, I don't have stability, They stepped in and said, "Hey, we've got a job for you."
Well, thank you so much for telling your story. It kind of puts a real face on the what's happening across the country. Thank you, appreciate that. I have a question, a follow up question for Paul. Some of the Trump administration are saying that it's fine to reduce government science because academia will just do it all, take over. Well, what do you say to that?
We've had an incredible exchange. Many of us are affiliate professors at different universities because we share graduate students and postdoctoral fellows and postmaster's fellows, and we collaborate. My laboratory has been a kind of a virtual laboratory over the last 43 years, and that's because we find the smartest people that we can work with wherever they are. We write grants together, and then we do work. And we parse that work among our colleagues who are working in same fields or allied fields. And one of the things that's really common about Forest Service research is that we have the ability, because we have career employees, we have the ability to work on projects over big space and big time. What that means is these are sort of longitudinal studies where we can study the spread and intensification of a pathogen, for example, across the landscape, and then build models that reflect how that works. Or we can study impacts of climate change on how different tree species are doing. And we can combine laboratory and greenhouse studies with what we're measuring in the field. So, and the other thing that's really important is we're finding out as the climate warms and it gets hot, dry, windy, these conditions are creating more large fires and more severe fires. What's driving that? Well, we're coming to understand when we study big landscape, which is something that really happens in government research. We can come to understand that landscapes have their own patterns and processes across big scales. And to study big landscapes and to show how conditions of the forest drive fire behavior, Those are expensive, long-term sorts of studies. So the collaboration between universities and federal research is that they complement each other and they overlap each other, but they're often not the same. We do big scale, big time studies. They often will do 2 and 3 year and perhaps longer studies that master's students and PhD students and postdoctoral fellows can do. We are able to do these bigger landscape studies often that are a complement to what's going on in the universities. That complementarity has been going on for many, many decades, and it's a rich and it's a robust environment. And the cross-fertilization between the government and university laboratories has been fabulous. And when you separate that, you're literally not having the ability to do some of those studies at a time when understand big landscape patterns and processes is literally center stage.
Mm-hmm. We're overdue for a break. Let's take a break. Jackie Lorcher, we're coming to you first. We've neglected you for a little while here, but we're coming to you first after the break. We're talking with several scientists. With our topic for today is the dismantling of government science. Americans have lost a generation of federal scientists, public land managers, and park rangers when the Trump administration fired thousands of government employees in 2025. And we're talking with Paul Hesburgh, who's now retired. Is that correct? Are you emeritus affiliate professor now? What's your title?
I'm an emeritus scientist, still working. I started my own company. I'm mostly working through my forest or my university affiliations.
Right. Okay. Now. All right.
Yeah.
Jackie Grant is executive director of the Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. That's the friends group of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And Anna Knight did work. You heard her story. Worked for the National Park Service, U.S. Geological Survey. Now is it ended up being caught up in that purge, and now works teaches classes, EMT classes for USU and Grand County EMS in Moab. Of course, we have with us Stephen Trimble, author of many books, including Bargaining for Eden, Sagebrush Ocean. The new edition is coming out in the fall. We'll have more following this break.
a geologist, a planetary scientist, a NASA mission leader, and an expert on team building walk into a bar. And the bartender says, "Hey, Lindy, drinking alone today?" How to be an interdisciplinarian. That's Undisciplined, Thursday morning at 10:30 on UPR.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. This week in E-Town, we're featuring part two of our special 35th anniversary deep dive into the E-Town archives with music from James Taylor, Joan Baez, Buddy Guy, Brandi Carlile, and my conversations with both Jane Goodall and astronauts in space. That's all this week in E-Town.
Tune in Saturday evening at 7 here on UPR.
Thanks for listening to Access U-Time, Tom Williams. It's Earth Day, and so we have with us, of course, writer and photographer Stephen Trimble, author of Bargaining for Eden and other books, and his classic Sagebrush Oceans coming out in a new edition later this year. We have with us three scientists talking to the topic of dismantling of government science. And we're talking with Paul Hesburgh, who's a affiliate professor at University of Washington, Jackie Grant, who is executive director of Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, and Anna Knight, who is was with government and science roles, now teaches classes for USU and Grand County EMS EMT classes in Moab. Before we turn to Jackie, the first question of the next, I wanted to follow up with Stephen Trimble. What's your view of this key question? The Trump administration, some in the administration are saying, well, it's okay to severely reduce government science because universities will just pick up the slack. You're muted, I believe. Yeah.
Paul told us a lot about the complementarity between universities and government science, and it's absolutely true. You know, my path was a little bit similar to Anna's. I was a park ranger at Artisan Capitol Reef in my 20s. And began writing and realized I didn't know enough natural history to be an authoritative writer. So I went back to grad school in ecology and didn't become an academic, kept being basically an interpreter of science and continued to write about science in my books. But I absolutely depend on scientists to provide the research, the facts, the natural history that I use to tell my stories about the natural world. And it's so crucial to have humans exploring the universe, basically. We just saw Artemis do that in their voyage to the moon, and we're doing it on a small scale everywhere in the West, on public lands especially. Jackie's going to be able to talk about the importance of Grand Staircase National Monument, but if we start taking away the people that do that work, we lose any chance we have for further understanding, and it ripples out into all different parts of our lives. And as we whack away at these federal agencies, it isn't that they just get smaller and still do their work. You know, I'm going to quote Tracy Stone Manning, who was the director of the BLM under President Biden and is now the president of the Wilderness Society. And she wrote this week in Writers on the Range about these ideas and issues and dangers of what's happening. And this is the simplest way to think about it. She said, "Think of your job, now think of half of your colleagues gone. Would your organization be able to recover from the loss and demoralization to do its work?" Mm. It's impossible.
Yeah. Well, let's do now turn to Jackie Grant, of course, with Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. So I want to have you talk about the role of partners. So you're center of an interconnected web of research, visitors, BLM, academic science, nonprofit advocacy. So first of all, the role of partners, and then how is that changing as BLM shifts away from research?
Right. The role of partners, I think you put it very well when you said there is an interconnected web, and sometimes I feel like the giant spider at the center of that web. We connect different federal agencies. We don't just work with the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument arm of the Bureau of Land Management. We work with the surrounding field offices, and that ranges from Cedar City Field Office, the Kanab Field Office, the Arizona Strip, and the St. George Field Office. So all of those BLM partners, different programs within the Bureau of Land Management, such as the Colorado Plateau Native Plant Program, the Seeds of Success Program, which is a national program to help conserve seeds from native plants and then grow out those seeds so that we have them in the millions needed, maybe billions of seeds that are needed to restore western lands and even eastern lands in the United States after disturbance events such as big wildfires. And we also work with the other agencies that are connected to the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument landscape, the state. We work very closely with the Great Basin Research Center and Seed Warehouse and the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative. We also work with the universities around the state, the University of Utah. We work with faculty and graduate students in the School of Biological Sciences, Red Butte Gardens, and Utah Tech. We work with a professor down there who does lizard surveys and invertebrate surveys and bat surveys on the monument at Southern Utah University here in Cedar City, where I'm located. They actually have a special collections in their library of all the research and not just scientific research, but other products related to the National Monument, like oral histories. And it's all in a special collection at Southern Utah University. And our organization, Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, helped along with the BLM to get that initial special collection up and rolling many years ago now. We work with researchers at Utah State University. And we also work with the Utah Native Plant Society because the monument is home to over 1,000 species of native plants, which also means that it's home to over 660 species of bees and many, many other pollinators, that some of which haven't even been described yet. So we are sitting in the nexus of a really important scientific area that is hugely unexplored, in part because of some of the connections that people have mentioned, not connections, some of the unfortunate events that have occurred in this last couple of years with early retirement programs and deferred resignation programs. The monument just lost more staff members, and they're down to about a third of BLM staff and scientists left. And that leaves us in a position of helping other organizations fill the role of getting onto the monument and doing the science that's needed so that we can really understand this place. And then we also work with tribal nations and tribal organizations, such as the Grand Staircase Escalante Intertribal Coalition, which just got formalized in the past year here. And they are doing great things to reconnect tribes to this landscape, because it's hugely important for the different tribes of the area that are connected through time immemorial to the area. And it holds, you know, significant spiritual connections to them and is part of how they live today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and we also work with the National Park Service.
Okay. So. Yeah. Yeah. Stephen, you want to take the next question? It looks like you're muted, Stephen.
A rookie mistake. I wanted to be a little bit more political. We're all being extremely restrained, other than Anna's harrowing story. And, you know, the monument, we know the Grand Staircase is under attack, right? The Utah congressional delegation led by Senator Mike Lee and Representative Celeste Malloy are trying to force the BLM to manage the monument as if it were a much smaller preserve. And the size of the monument matters. Science is the reason. And all of you focus on landscape scale ecology. Any of you, could you talk a little bit more about that scale that Paul talked a little bit about? It really matters in managing and preserving landscapes at scale. All the way from the Mojave Desert, all the way up to Moab, we have created these large preserves, national monuments, national parks, they're all connected. If we start chopping them up into small bits, what happens? Who wants to take that?
Sure, I can start. This is Jackie. And one thing that we know about from a scientific perspective is the effects of habitat fragmentation. So every time we take a landscape and chop it into a little bit smaller piece, the edges become more exposed, and the organisms, the animals and plants that live inside of that piece of land then are closer to disturbances. And there is more opportunity for people to get into the center where maybe there is a plant there that was living and thriving because it was not exposed to human disturbance. But as the pieces of land get smaller and roads go into those lands or trails, then these animals and plants become exposed to disturbances and it becomes more difficult for them to thrive in their environment.
Paul, looks like you wanted to jump in. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take a stab. Paul here. I've been studying big landscapes for a long time. I've been fascinated with them, and I was fascinated because I saw things happen. I didn't understand how things worked. So I was trying to figure out how landscape worked, and I spent decades reconstructing conditions from the early to the late 20th century to say, what changed? Why are insect outbreaks bad? Why are wildfires getting worse? And we did a lot of studies that basically grounded our understanding in changes in empirical work. And then we built simulation models to say, what does that change when you've got a wildfire ignition or you've got a new bark beetle in the area and you've got a lot of host? And one of the things that we noticed is landscapes themselves have very large scale behavior. And in fact, it's that large scale behavior that drives the bus. And what I mean by that is landscapes, insect outbreaks, for example, or wildfires, they're a contagion process. They move through connected conditions across the landscape. If I'm a mountain pine beetle, I like to attack stressed trees. So if there's an awful lot of stands of lodgepole pine that are overly dense and layered, stressed trees are in those stands. But if they're connected to each other, then beetles will emerge after they've bred and killed lodgepole pine to adjacent stands that are also low vigor, and they'll kill those. And so you see this phenomenon of an outbreak building and building in other places. And so you, instead of having a natural bark beetle doing its influence, you have a native insect doing non-native things across the landscape. The same is really true with wildfire behavior. There's this, we've studied from very large landscapes, we study that there's this tug of war going on between fires and forest growth to rebalance and stabilize stored potential energy. And right now we're carrying way too much forest biomass on the landscape. And we can only find that by studying how fires interacted with vegetation over space and time. And what happened is that on forest capable ground, places that can grow trees, wetlands, wet and dry meadows, savannas, woodlands, all sorts of places emerged in the process of restabilizing how much stored potential energy you can keep on the ground. The highest potential energy state is a forested condition. There's so much carbon and biomass available. When it's hot and dry and windy, that stuff's going to go unless it's separated by these other non-forest elements. And so we can only understand across big spaces that landscapes themselves have a functionality. And if you want them to operate more benignly, you have to cooperate with how landscapes want to work. Okay, and so there's many examples of that kind of big landscape idea about connections between pattern and process. And the human community is connected in the exact same way to these landscapes. So this social and ecological community condition is highly influenced by what's going on big landscapes. They're fascinating things to study, and we're just chipping away at the surface of it right now. But understanding how to stabilize and work with landscapes over climate change time is becoming a huge topic. And if we want them to behave more benignly, we're going to have to continue studying how they work and what it takes to be able to tip them in new directions.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Anna, you told me a great little story about what you see in dryland landscapes with disruption in the parallel really between science and politics and what you saw as an ecologist. Could you tell us that story?
Yeah, I'd love to. This is a great lead-in from Paul's intro of how ecological succession works, actually. So a lot of my work on the Colorado Plateau has been trying to understand how disturbance impacts the landscape and how ecosystems may respond to multiple disturbances or extreme disturbances, and how they recover from those disturbances. And one thing that we see in many ecosystems, and especially common in drylands, is that if you have a severe enough disturbance, you can actually push a community, an ecological community, over a threshold. So in some cases, if you have an intermediate level of disturbance, you might have the same climax community return in the same place after a disturbance. But if you add on the stressors, you create a very severe disturbance or have multiple stressors, or maybe have a disturbance under climate change where the conditions that led to the original climax community are no longer there during the recovery time, you can cross this threshold where it's no longer possible to get that historic community back in a place. And we can see an example of this when we think about the role of improper grazing and drought in the history of canyonlands. So I've worked for a long time on this long-term research study in canyonlands in the Needles District, where in the early part of the 1900s, that area was a hotbed for cattle ranching and actually was the site of one of the biggest cattle operations in the American West for a while. And that area that was used so intensely for that cattle operation, when we compared that area to other areas of the park that had less intense grazing, we still see impacts of that grazing because those soil crust communities and vegetation communities have not returned to what we assume that they probably were by looking at other parts of the landscape. They've not returned to that state, even after 20 years of grazing exclosure, right? So the lease has expired when the park was established. But those sites in the front country zones of the Needles still have lower biodiversity in their soil crust communities. And less cover of soil crust, even after 50 years of just letting it alone and protecting it. And so it's really possible with these really severe disturbances to push systems to a point where they lose processes and they maybe lose seed banks or they lose whatever they need to reestablish. And I think of that as a parallel to what's happening in federal land management agencies and federal science research agencies, in that this is a huge disturbance right now, and there's a huge loss of staffing, there are major reorganizations, and those changes can potentially lead to a loss of institutional knowledge. And I think if we lose a lot of that institutional knowledge and we lose enough of those people, we may approach a threshold where even if policies change to be more supportive of those systems, we may never be able to get back the institutions that we had 2 or 3 years ago. And that's a big fear of mine. And I think that concerted effort to prevent further disruption to these institutions and maybe envisioning what a new stable system for federal science could look like in the future is really critical right now. Mm.
We're overdue for a break. We'll go toward a break. But before we go to break, Stephen Trimble, want to have you get your comment on this. You obviously are alarmed by this, but what do you think? Maybe expand what you think we lose when we lose these connections.
Well, entire disciplines are now going to be poorly represented or just absent in managing the federal lands. You know, it's just astonishing to me the cavalier attitude toward science that the administration is showing us. You know, shutting down the climate observations on the top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii that have been going for decades and decades and decades, attacking the NCAR facility outside of Boulder that keeps track of climate change and data on weather, that you need consistency. You know, you can't just go back and start up again because you've lost years of data if those operations are shut down. And it's hard for me to understand the motivation here. I actually think that the motivation for a lot of this is to destroy federal science and federal management of public lands, make it so bad that the states get their wish of having federal lands turned over to the states with this myth that the federal government can't manage them. You know, there's an enormous attitude toward commodification that we're fighting against.
Let's go ahead toward a break here. You're listening to Access Utah, and we're talking to the topic of the dismantling of government science. And we have with us Stephen Trimble, author of many books. I'll just mention here, 35th anniversary edition of his classic book, Sagebrush Ocean, is coming out in the fall. We have with us Anna Knight, who did work in government science and now teaches EMT classes for USU and Grand County EMS in Moab. We have with us Paul Hesburgh, who's an affiliate professor at University of Washington. Jackie Grant is executive director of Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. We'll have more following this break.
We're in a time of turmoil here and worldwide in government, political attack, secrecy, and war. We asked our listeners to help pick music and musicians for us that deal with our troubles, and we added a few of our own. Join us for a program named after a jazz classic, Compared to What? On American Roots.
Tune in Saturday evening at 8 here on UPR.
Hi, this is Steve Williams, and you can tune in for a selection of jazz music from the Jazz Time with Steve Williams Archives. We've got locals coming up. The late Joe McQueen, my good friend, and made it to 100. And we'll try to get a couple more locals. It's a wonderful way to close out the weekend, and I hope you'll tune in. That's Sunday from 6 to 10 p.m. here on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. It's Earth Day today. We are therefore checking in with writer and photographer Stephen Trimble, author of Bargaining for Eden, many other books. I'll mention here that his classic, The Sagebrush Ocean, is being updated, 35th anniversary edition, coming out in the fall. And we're talking to the topic this time around, the dismantling of government science. We have with us Paul Hesburgh, who's affiliate professor at University of Washington, Jackie Grant, executive director of Grand Staircase Escalante Partners, and Anna Knight, who teaches EMT classes for USU and Grand County EMS in Moab, formerly was with the government, and with the firing and forced retirements, et cetera, from the Trump administration, got caught up in that as well. Let me turn to Paul here at the beginning of this segment. You've spent years studying climate change and wildfires. You've talked about that earlier in the program. I wonder if you could maybe expand a little more on the impacts of current policy decisions on resilience and fire ecology.
Sure. Can I riff on Stephen's last comment?
Yeah, yes. Yes, go ahead. Time? Yeah, I love it.
Over a period of 42, 43 years, I've had a chance to mentor close to 50 master's and PhD students and numerous postdocs. And the mentorship thing in science is ultra critical for maintaining a chain of bright people who get to do timely work and transmit that for impact. Many of senior scientists in many agencies have retired, and we've lost so many junior scientists who are sharp as tacks and have incredible ability, and losing them breaks the chain of smart people doing great and timely work. And the passing on of that, I'm almost reminded of the pernicious influence on our original people, where we separated grandparents from parents from children. That was an incredible influence on traditional knowledge passing on, and a similar thing. And so our Western scientific knowledge is also not being as transmitted as it might be. And that's a huge impact. And I've experienced it in my lab and many of my partner laboratories. So the question of resilience.
Resilience and wildfires, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we kept fire out of the woods for between 100 and 170, 175 years. It depends on when the curtailment of indigenous burning really was high impact. And there's been an epidemic of trees across much of the West. And what that really means is when you take fire out of the woods, which was constantly thinning and keeping resilient conditions, what happens is on forest capable ground, trees march back. They migrate into, grow into wet and dry meadows, open savannas. They dewater wetlands, all of those kinds of things. So we have a lot more forest, and it's denser and it's layered right now. And that's been a primary influence in the forested environment on how forests will actually accept fire, whether it's culturally ignited, lightning ignited, or accidentally ignited. And so we have a big, well-connected, highly flammable landscape. And what that does is it changes how forests in large landscapes actually worked historically for millennia. The indigenous influence in many geographies was very, very significant, both regionally and locally. And essentially, folks during that period, our original people, had to live on the landscape, find food, forage, live safely, live securely in the landscape, and use fire as a primary tool, hundreds of different ways to live on that landscape. Take that fire out of the landscape and you're excluding it for a very long time. Trees march back to places that they can grow in. They become well connected. There's a lot more forest. There's a lot less of these non-forest elements, and resilience tanks at a very large scale. So we in fire suppression for years and years was effective at putting out 95 to 98% of all fires. Those were actually fires that were doing great work historically. Today, only the largest fires that escape fire suppression, initial attack, are the ones that are working the landscape. And they're very large, they're very severe, and they're basically won over resilience. They're the opposite of the way these landscapes historically worked.
Well, thank you for that. We're down to about 5 minutes left in the program. It's gone by quickly. Stephen Trimble, you want to take the probably the last question here?
Well, thanks, Tom. Thanks so much for having us on. You know, this is such an important topic. And Americans understand this attack on science. You know, the Colorado College State of the Rockies survey every year checks in with Westerners about their attitudes toward public lands. And 86% of Westerners say funding cuts to management of public lands is a serious problem. 82% of Westerners are concerned about fewer biologists working in government agencies. Even in Utah, that figure is 79%. And it just goes on and on. 91% of Westerners are concerned about too few firefighters. 91% believe existing national monument designations should remain in place. And so the government and our congressional representatives are working to create new policies that the American public does not support. And this fight against public lands and public science and civil servants doing visionary work is absolutely opposite to what the American public wants. But those are the folks who have power. And it's up to us to express our outrage about the attacks on these places that we love. You know, if we get rid of tens of thousands of civil servants and federal employees and the people that understand these places and have understood them over generations, just as Paul said, we are losing so much wisdom and so much possibility. And, you know, it was so inspiring to watch the moonshot, the four people that talked about looking back at Earth and thinking of us as a crew, just like they were a crew, and seeing how little the president paid attention to that. You know, science pulls people together. And the current people in power of the American government don't want to see people pull together. And so not only do we create new knowledge with science, but it's a community action. We're all participating as we learn and grow together to take care of these places that we all love. And so I am horrified. I'm hoping that all of us will express our outrage. And I thought actually that if we have time, Tom, I have just a couple of paragraphs from Bargaining for Eden that I thought I'd read.
Okay, sure. Yeah, just have about a minute here. Yeah.
Okay. These describe my father and his buddies who work for the U.S. Geological Survey. And it tells you a little bit about how I feel about these government scientists. Their field work mixed the physical and the cerebral. They drove jeeps and forded rivers and sweat-stained their hat bands. They mused in grand scale, comfortable with the millions and billions of geologic time, but they spent their days in physical contact with the earth, picking up rocks warmed by the sun, collecting rough horn coral fossils and knife-sharp chunks of obsidian, kneeling to measure grain size and the angles of rocks jutting from the surface of the planet. In my childhood, I chose my father's lineage for my connections. Geology was the bedrock underlying patriarchy. Science was our religion. Western history and natural history, our tribal lore. The public domain of the West, our holy land. Like my father, I took as my prophets the explorers, scientists, and writers journeying and journaling across the continent. A subliminal message ran through this history that government was good. From Lewis and Clark themselves to John Wesley Powell and the 19th century surveys, Aldo Leopold and Bob Marshall's invention of the modern concept of wilderness while working for the Forest Service, the stories that nourished me featured federal bureaucrats as heroes. I grew up with the assumption that civil servants did visionary work. They still do, mm-hmm. and we need to protect them.
Good place to end the program. We've been talking with Paul Hesburgh, who is affiliate professor at University of Washington. Paul Hesburgh, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Thank
Great
you.
Chatting with you.
Jackie Grant is executive director of the Grand Staircase Escalante Partners. Thank you.
You're welcome. Hope you can join us on a trip someday.
Yes, yes, that would be fun. Ananide is an ecologist focused on landscape scale vegetation dynamics. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Stephen Trimble, writer and photographer, Bargaining for Eden. We heard a segment just then, and we'll mention here that a 35th anniversary edition of The Sagebrush Ocean is coming out in the fall. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for doing this, Tom. And thanks especially to Anna for being so willing to share her harrowing story.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate that. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.